Well, we're talking about the movie Expelled comes up in April. Mark Mathis is the producer of this Ben Stein hosted film. And we're just getting into some of the meatier parts, too, of this. I find the discussion fascinating. And it makes me, again, sing the praises of Coast to Coast AM, a show where we can talk about anything. And there is no doctrine that we have to adhere to in order to sort of be consistent. We're all over the road. We'll often talk about, in one breath, aliens having a hand in the formation of humanity as we know it. And then the next, it is about whether there could have been some divine hand or whether or not there's truth to those prints that they found in Texas of a human being walking side by side with a dinosaur. Whatever the case is, it's nice to know that at least Coast to Coast is doing the job that we thought they were doing. And the science departments at universities and colleges across the country, we'll get back to that. The things that they told Mark Mathis and Ben Stein, these heads of department, these pillars of modern science, what did they tell the producers of the movie Expelled? And for that matter, is it ever possible that Darwinism, as we know it today, is actually dangerous? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Mark Mathis, the producer of Expelled. So I'll save the question about the possibility of neo-Darwinism being dangerous, which I think is an interesting question that you float in the trailer for the movie that folks can link up to at coasttocoastam.com. But you have some fairly well-known people in the documentary coming up in April. You get some well-known people who are pretty frank about the fact that they just don't think that there needs to be any other theory other than the theory of evolution, that explains it, it's over, it's done, and nothing else should even ever enter into the equation. Am I overstating it?
No, we have most of the heavy hitters from the elitist side of the scientific establishment speaking in this film. So we have the Richard Dawkins, who is author of the international bestseller, The God Delusion. We have Christopher Hitchens, the author of God is Not Great. Daniel Dennett, a philosopher, author of Breaking the Spell. You can just go down the list. Eugenie Scott, the head of the National Center for Science Education. Michael Roos, who's also a big scientist in this field. We have, one after another, we've got them in this film.
And what do they say? What are some of the things that you consider to be outrageous, which they just simply admit to as a matter of fact?
Oh, boy. where do you start? One of the things that really comes across that is just so insulting is the complete disdain and hostility that these people have, the arrogance of their position, that they're absolutely so certain that they're correct and that all of the 90% of the population that it disagrees with them, they were just, these stupid, idiotic, unwashed masses. And it's really amazing the contempt and the arrogance that these people have toward their common man. They stand on this high intellectual ground and look down their noses at the rest of the people. This is palpable, and it comes out in interview after interview after interview. People...
What?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I mean, the idea of being snubbed by academics, that's nothing new. I mean, they have doctor in front of their name and I don't. And that means a lot more to them than it means to me. But I mean, so be it. And that's their job, isn't it, to be intellectually snooty?
No. Well, they can certainly be snooty, but their job is to be intellectually honest. Is to allow any question that has validity to be asked, not to exclude arguments before they can even be made, not to sell out to their own dogmatic worldview, not to completely sell out to their own personal biases, and exclude the other positions that they disagree with. I mean, science is supposed to be an area where you acknowledge that you have biases. We all have biases. we all have inherent biases. In science, we're supposed to recognize our own biases and then try to minimize the impact of those biases so that they're not, that they don't cloud our judgment. And that's not what's going on in science today. What we have are our scientists who've, they've completely exchanged one of the most valuable tools that they have, which is skepticism, and exchanged it for a dogmatic view that says, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that I'm right about this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I remember when I was watching the mini docket, there was a guy on there who said, look, I just don't want a competing theory. I just don't want
right.
one. I just, well, I mean, I think, well, okay, well, that makes his job a lot easier. And who doesn't want their job to be easier? I mean, I sort of resonated with the candor of that, that, you know, it's just too hard if we have two different competing theories.
Well, and then also if you've got other people into the mix who are going to be taking from your resource base. You keep in mind how much money is spent in science. I mean, we have $50 billion a year spent on scientific research, and these people own it all. They don't want anybody else who's got a different point of view taking some of those research dollars and wasting them.
Let me turn it around on you. What should be excluded? Is there anything at the university level that they shouldn't bother with?
Well, there's certainly you have to have boundaries in science,
right?
Where you say, okay, there's certain areas that we're not going to go, but you don't ever completely say that these walls are absolutely concrete and this idea, no matter how ridiculous it may sound today, can never get in, because all ideas have to have the opportunity for a scientist, a researcher, to say, wait a minute, this is a viable idea, and here is my scientific proposition for how it is, so that I can make a compelling case, make a good argument.
That's good theory, but I'm going to make you put it into a more practical context. Let's just say, at a university level, a guy there becomes a neo-Nazi, not a neo-Darwinist, he's a neo-Nazi. He mm-hmm. becomes convinced of the superiority of white people. And he spends he uses his university position to espouse this belief that that the creator made one race to be the keeper of all races on the planet, and has the moral and the spiritual superiority to be able to decide who lives and who dies. You wouldn't want that, right?
What you just described has already existed. I mean, this is what happened in Nazi Germany.
Right, exactly.
And
so, I mean, you would say, okay, not at this university. If you publish that article, it would be okay for that person to lose their tenure?
I tell you what, we've got people saying those kinds of things and worse. I mean, we've got university professors who are saying things like, you know, human beings are, you know, essentially, you know, a cancer or parasites on the planet, and that
right.
it would be a good idea that if about 90% of the population was wiped out, the human population, so that Earth can heal itself. These
right.
things are discussed freely on university campuses. You can almost talk about almost anything, but you can't talk about the idea that, wait a minute, maybe there's intelligence in the universe. Maybe we can scientifically identify the fingerprints of intelligence.
I seem to remember the co-discoverer, as it were, of DNA, that Watson guy. He made a bunch of racist statements, and next thing you know, his class schedule was trimmed, and he was facing a kind of academic sanctions as a result of making a bunch of statements in his new book and in interviews in England. And there was a reaction to him for taking positions like that. It wasn't he was being shunned, if you will, for going down that road.
And as I was saying, you need to have boundaries in science. And if somebody is going to advance a viewpoint that is that they can't readily defend scientifically, and that it's just something that stirs the pot and inflames people, you know, those kinds of things shouldn't be tolerated. But you know, that's pretty different than what we're talking about here.
Okay,
we're talking about a scientific theory of the biggest question ever asked, and you've got really significant problems in this theory, such as how in the world does life become from non-life? We've been asking this question, and you know, 150 years beyond Darwin's theory, which Darwin was provided an intellectual dodge on that question. He didn't even address it. But we still don't even have a plausible idea of how it might have happened, let alone an explanation for how it did. We don't know where information comes from. Now, we've got the hardware. We can look at the DNA, but we don't know where information comes from. Where is this? Where's the instruction manual? We haven't even been able to identify that yet.
Right.
But we look at genetic studies, and what we see is that mutations destroy information. So how is it that this theory, Darwinism, which is grounded in the idea that mutations give us all of what we see in life, and the great complexity and diversity and everything, is built on a mutation process, when our genetic studies show that mutations destroy information, they don't build it? You know, we've got all these big problems with this theory. So how is it that we can completely embrace this theory, teach it as fact in high schools and universities, to the complete exclusion of the only other possibility for which there is some significant interest and some significant credibility that this is a viable theory that we can scientifically find intelligence in the universe?
All right. I like that. You do kind of hint at this idea that Darwinism is dangerous, that there's something about this which causes harm, which goes unexplored.
Well, yes. Well, any time a society embraces this idea that we're all just a big cosmic accident, that there is no, you know, baseline for, there's no greater meaning in life. There is no foundation for morals and ethics. We're just, it's, you know, you just find your way, and everything's survival of the fittest. And that personal responsibility then becomes something that gets turns into something very not ill-defined, so that it reaches into such things as, you know, life itself, the sanctity of life. It becomes very easy to merge into areas such as eugenics, which the United States did you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, and certainly many others, including Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union did, you know, eugenics, or you have euthanasia, or abortion. I mean, it becomes much easier to abort life when the life really has no ultimate meaning. It's just, you know, we're all just here as a result of an accident.
Yeah, that brings up a question, and it is interesting to me, because you don't have to go back too far to find sort of the accepted and had been mainstream university junk science, what we would consider to be junk science today, but having its own departments as recent as, say, in the 50s or 60s, before somehow science changed its mind that couldn't possibly be right and couldn't be science.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring up eugenics and even social Darwinism,
eugenics was widely accepted. All of the finest academics and scientists of the day fully embraced eugenics. They thought that we could advance and purify the species of man through being careful to not allow people who are unfit to breed. And so who's going to decide who's unfit? You know, a lot of people were determined to be unfit because they were intellectually inferior, and they were involuntarily sterilized. Now, these are the kinds of areas that you get into when you fully embrace a Darwinian philosophy.
Yeah, but I would argue, and I don't know whether there's truth to this or not, because I haven't studied it. Maybe you know more about it, that the people that were actually creating these programs of sterilization, or, you know, the Margaret Sangers or other people who kind of founded whole new movements toward the molding of society, that they weren't a religious, that they weren't atheistic, they consider this to be part of a mission, you know, to make over our planet, our country, you know, in the image of God as they saw it.
I don't know about that.
I'd love to go back and see the people who did the Tuskegee Institute experiments and find out whether they were all atheists or whether they also had a very, you know, a faith-based perspective that what they were doing was somehow in a greater way, capital R, right.
Hmm. Well, there are always people around who are finding good ideas to eliminate, reduce, exterminate people that they don't like and are willing to seize upon all sorts of justifications to do that. That's not just something that it can result as the result of a materialist worldview, because certainly we see where this happens in, you know, extreme fundamentalist religions do these same sorts of thing.
Right, because,
you can't just carve out and own just this one thing as being a driver for this kind of behavior, because there are other things, other possible drivers as well.
Well, fair enough. I just mean you have cases of people who are ultra-religious who decide that abortion doctors don't have a right to live. And they
Correct.
Make a, right? I mean, and so we just may be looking at two ends, extreme ends of the same spectrum in your movie Expelled, which is coming up in April, and in some of those other stories that
I've
mentioned.
Well, the difference in what we talk about in Expelled, and we do go into the area of Nazi Germany, is it's different for a individual or a small sect of individuals to imbibe some very wrong ideas and espouse them. That's very different than an entire society which takes on this view and then allows the end result of that to happen, to go out and exterminate an entire race, or at least attempt to go out and systematically exterminate people that are deemed to be unfit, who are useless eaters. Now, when your government is sponsoring this kind of behavior, that's a whole another level. And then that's kind of what we get into in the film, and not just, you know, what some fringe groups thinking.
Okay. How much is the government involved in this? I mean, is there collusion on the part of government?
Involved in what?
In the expulsion or the restriction of these other ideas when it comes to creation? I mean, if it's intellectual...
Well, the government is involved to the extent that you have people who are within the government who all subscribe, well, not all, but most subscribe to a certain philosophy. And because you have, you know, some of these folks are in government positions. I mean, you're a university professor, you know, you're employed by the university. Or you're running a scientific institution. So there is certainly some government crossover, but I don't think that is something. I don't know that government itself, other than it becomes just a great enabler, because what we see in society, and we're seeing and certainly in this debate, is that with government positions and with academic positions, there's a complete lack of accountability. I mean, these people are allowed to do and say and persecute. And, you know, in the case, for example, that we highlight in the film of Richard von Sternberg, where he was completely mistreated by several large science organizations and the Smithsonian.
Hang on to that thought. We'll come right back to that, and we'll get all the phone numbers so you can join the conversation, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Now, most shows, I can kind of get an idea of where questions are going to go when you all start engaging the guest. I'm at a loss on this one. Not exactly sure how this is going to go, but I'm looking forward to hearing about it coming up in just a minute. Grab a line if you want to be a part of the conversation we're having with Mark Mathis about this movie, which is due in April 18th. It's called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. You can find out more about it at coasttocoastam.com. And if you go there, you can link up to my blog, which I put the crypto news items from earlier in the evening on. Also, there is a couple of new news stories Third Texas officer comes forward on UFO sighting, the Stevensville story. And now a third person going on the record with a law enforcement reputation to lose, but coming forward and just saying what he saw that night of this unexplained UFO sighting, and what he says that's consistent with all of the others, and why seemingly he would have nothing to gain by coming out and making this claim now. Also, as long as we're talking about life both here and on other planets and who created it and how, there is a new story from the Harvard Crimson, which we've linked up to at coasttocoastam.com, about how the Mars surface is too acidic for life to exist. And since we're always talking about 9/11 on this show, and there have been many different opinions on 9/11, in particular about the Pentagon and whether or not a plane went into the Pentagon, whether it's possible, whether the science exists, I think you need to go look at a video that is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, which purports to show to skeptics how a plane could be obliterated, how it could essentially be atomized as it hits a hard surface. You know, jets move at a very high speed, and they are essentially a shell. You know, they're a light shell around these very, you know, these big tanks of fuel and these big engines. Go take a look at that video, and whether that challenges your belief that a plane did not go into the side of the Pentagon, that it must have been a missile. Go look at that video. That conversation will continue too. You'll find more at coasttocoastam.com, and I look forward to getting back to the conversation wherever it may lead us. Unlike what they do in academia, where they try to control the outcome, we won't. You'll talk to Mark Mathis next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Mark Mathis, producer of Expelled with Ben Stein. Ken is in California, first-time caller line on Coast to Coast AM for Mark Mathis. Go ahead, Ken.
Hey, I would just like to point out, along with your guest tonight, that part of the reason, at least, for the conflict between evolution and ID in educational institutions is that the theory of evolution really is itself a religion and has always been a religion and is, in fact, today nothing more than a metaphysical worldview that parades around in the garments of religion backed by a scientific priesthood. Historically, evolution has always been represented as a religious philosophy. If you go all the way back to Thales of Miletus and to the Greek atomist, you can trace the progress of this theory, but never in a scientific context, always in a religious one. And certainly its use in the 20th century reveals its religious nature, because it was the justification used by some of the greatest monsters of all time, including Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler, to justify their crimes.
Well, you know, let's not forget, though, too. I mean, Adolf Hitler also used a religious justification, especially
yes.
in the earliest years.
Certainly.
And it wasn't a Darwinian kind of religion. But let me get to Mark Mathis's response to that. Mark, what do you say to Ken?
Ken is correct in that, you know, if the evolution, the idea that there was these material causes has its roots in a religious context, in the idea of what would be called theistic evolution, which was a philosophy that said that a God that did not have to tinker with his creation was a more powerful, a stronger God. So he creates the universe, he creates the world, he gets the ball rolling and moving, and then he steps back. And this, then, is a more powerful God. So the idea actually has a religious or a spiritual origin.
Well, that sounds like the classic deistic watchmaker explanation of God. But I think, to go to his point, though, that somehow scientists are like priests in the high temple of evolution, and that they treat it as a kind of religion.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think that's true?
Okay. Oh, yes, yes.
process. And when you look at what, I mean, you have to look at, a lot of times people will ask me, they'll say, well, I don't understand what drives these people. What do they care? I mean, why is this so important to them? But when you look at what's involved here, this theory involves all of their power, their prestige, their treasure, their past, their future, their identity, and most importantly, the foundation of their worldview. They can't allow this thing to be attacked. They are the superior high priests of the origins of life. And they look down their nose and dictate and explain to the rest of us in their highly complicated way how it is that they know all the things that we don't know.
So, in a way, if the theory of evolution is proven to be false, then they're just...
They're the creators.
They're highly intellectual members of a flat earth society.
There you go.
Okay. Len is in Chicago, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Len, the new movie is called Expelled, and it attempts to reveal the sort of academic world that is controlling thought in science departments at universities and colleges. Where are you with that, Len?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Excellent. Well, you know, your guest made an interesting distinction at the beginning of the show between intelligent design and creation, and basically defining intelligent design as seeing patterns, even intelligent patterns, in nature and the universe. And I'm down with that. But why does intelligent design necessarily have to exclude something like evolution, which seems to me like
it doesn't.
It doesn't?
No. Let me touch on that. Most of your leading intelligent design scientists are actually very comfortable with the idea of evolution. What they're uncomfortable with is a completely materialistic explanation for how it came about. So they look at evolution and they say, well, it would make sense to us that there was a designer that designed the universe, perhaps, the physical laws, perhaps, that then used uploaded information and then allowed evolution to then proceed from there. But the question then becomes is, where does the information come from? That's the big question. And a materialistic neo-Darwinian approach, which is what's taught in high schools and universities, doesn't provide an explanation for that.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you there. I definitely think that there's limits to science in viewing the universe as strictly a materialistic sense. I mean, science is an excellent tool for the mechanics of the observable universe, but I think that's about the extent of its usefulness. So thanks a lot for your comments.
Thanks, Lynn. I'm glad you use that word, observable. Would it not be fair to say, then, that that's maybe the operative word here in this conflict, that God is not observable, and so as a result, you can't use an argument for an intelligent designer in a scientific context?
That's what the scientific establishment would tell you, is that you're talking about something that lies outside of the physical world, so therefore it is disqualified as science, period, which is a bogus argument. I mean, if we were to sort of suspend ourselves here for a moment, and let's just imagine that, in fact, okay, we know truth, and that truth is that there is a God, and that God set up the world, and that he's outside of the observable world, but set up the world, and here are the mechanisms for how all this is going to take place. And we know this to be true. Then we move back into the world that we're in today. We say, well, no, that we have to completely exclude the possibility of the existence of God, because we can't see it in the observable universe. You see, it doesn't make any sense.
Okay. Well, I guess I go back to, even in a metaphoric context, I mean, you'll hear Albert Einstein, who was a self-avowed atheist, yet he used God all the time as a sort of figure of speech. Do not scientists still do that anymore, where they use even God in that limited context?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Right. I just remember Einstein would say that all the time, although he claiming at the same time to not actually be religious. Let me get to Robert in Florida, Wildcard Line on Coast to Coast AM. Robert?
Hi.
Hi, you're talking with Mark Mathis, producer of Expelled, coming in theaters in April.
Yes.
The earlier caller touched on the same thing I was. Isn't it their religion that they blindly follow, but yet they're right and nobody, their way is the only way? And doesn't that describe another religion?
It certainly has taken on that flavor, where the support of this theory has come to a place where it actually qualifies as a religion. It's that their intense promotion and defense of this philosophy is religious in how they pursue it. I would say yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Robert. Go ahead.
There's a natural. You there?
Yeah, we're waiting. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I thought it was cut off. There's a natural part of a human being that wants to worship. And since they don't have a faith in God, they have to find it somewhere else. So they've created their own God or their own religion, and they follow it.
Well, I've always said that everybody puts their faith in something. And so maybe that's what you're hinting at there, too. And I really do believe this, that everybody on the planet is fundamentalist about something.
About something, yeah.
About something.
Well, one of the criticisms that is made about intelligent design, or even creationism for that matter, is that the people who are advancing these ideas advance an idea of God of the gaps, which is that if it can't be explained, then God must have done it. And this is their look down their nose criticism of intelligent design. And in fact, the ironic thing is that when you look at all of the very significant challenges to neo-Darwinian theory, what you have here is Darwin of the gaps, where these big, big problems exist, and they're saying, well, we don't have any explanation for this yet, but we will one day. So it's very hypocritical, because they're launching stink bombs at the side that they're completely excluding from the debate, and yet they're committing the same thing.
But ain't that always the way, that we become what we mock? Laura is in Pennsylvania on Coast to Coast AM on the wildcard line for Mark Mathis, producer of the movie Expelled. Laura?
Hi, very interesting. Now, I have a bad battery in case I go dead. Now, I don't think these particular...
You don't mean that on your pacemaker. You mean that on your cell phone, I hope?
On my cordless phone.
Okay, but we don't have to send out a search party for you.
So, you know, just know I didn't get mad and hang up.
Okay, all right.
I don't think these scientists are what I would call true scientists, but it's unfortunate that they people like this do get in control, and there's power and power and money in that. And like you said, Ian, and happy birthday, but she said not to chat.
Yeah.
There should be open-mindedness, especially in a university. And the idea of the origin of life is a philosophy. And any true scientist will get to a point where they are willing to say, well, we don't know. And, darn it, she wanted me to be so fast.
Well, let me just address.
Go ahead, Laura,
the
especially.
Of species, the Darwin. There's a lot to it. He is not synonymous with evolution. I mean, evolution is evolution, and Darwin is just another. They're giving him an awful lot. They're making him synonymous with evolution, and mostly what he learned about was things like natural selection and stuff like that.
Okay, well, let's get a response. Let's get a response from Mark here, and thank you, Laura. God bless you. Go ahead.
You know, well, the first parts of her comments. Really is why this film was made, which is that we need to have the freedom, that we need to have the intellectual honesty to say, okay, we don't have all the answers on this side of the question, which is atheistic, materialistic neo-Darwinism. This is what's taught in our schools. And to be honest enough to say, all right, we're all these scientists, we believe that this is the way that it happened, but we don't have anywhere near all the evidence to prove that. So there's another view that says that there's design and intelligence in the universe, you know, that if they're being honest as scientists, they would not systematically exclude that point of view. That is unscientific, and it's wrong. And so all we're arguing for is the idea that intelligence in the universe as a scientific hypothesis is a valid scientific theory and should be allowed to be discussed in the university system without persecution of the scientists who would have the courage to discuss this. That's all we're saying.
Kevin gets the last thought on this, and I'll tell you more about that in just a second. Kevin, go ahead.
Hi, I have a question and then a follow-up.
Got to be quick.
I think the debate is immaterial on all of this. I mean, there's no arguing makes either side more true. And with so many variables, you know, in religion, in philosophy, and whatever, why do we pick these two rigid sides to argue when they don't tend to speak for everyone?
Okay, and what's your follow-up?
My follow-up is, I'm sure that you are familiar with the concept of Schrodinger's cat, the thought experiment for quantum mechanics. I think that can be applied in science as far as the existence of a creator versus not, that the variable is there a God, is there not a God, and every equation must account for both. So anything, if it equals whether there is a God or is not a God, that then the whatever is being postulated is true.
All right, let's leave that there. And I tell you what, I'm gonna call an audible here, Mark.
Okay.
And I'm gonna say that I think for the purposes of our discussion tonight, at least I wonder how you feel about this. But I hit every point I wanted to make. I got every question I wanted to ask. And not being a believer in holding people over until a final hour just because I've got another hour coming up, I wondered whether what we'll do, if you'd be all right with this, let's just adjourn on this for now, and then, barring anything that you really felt you wanted to say here at the end, we'll just, like, you know, we'll reconvene on this coming up in April, closer to when the movie opens, and we'll do a little bit more about it on the air before the movie opens. What do you think?
That sounds good to me.
I mean, you're welcome to stay up an extra hour later if you'd like, but I think I could go to open lines here and find, you know, plenty of things to talk about in the last hour, and I'll get some email in, I'm sure, on some of the things we talked about. But you were so clear, you were so concise, you gave great answers, and I'm afraid we just end up kind of repeating a couple of things for the rest of the show. And I just think you did it a great job. So I look forward, and I will get more people to go to the website and to go look at the trailer, and so they get a better idea of this movie and where you're going with it. And I thank you so much for your openness and the way you discussed it and all the ways in which you handled the different questions.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Sure.
And, good. And I look forward to getting you back. Maybe you grab Ben Stein on with you the next time you come back. All right.
I'll try to do it.
You try. I know he's a big shot, but thank you so much. And then we'll just spend the last hour open lines. Where do you want to go? And you can pick up there on this conversation if you want to, or take us into entirely different directions for our last hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.